Welcome to Backstage at Upstage, a presentation of Upstage Lung Cancer, which uses the performing arts to raise awareness and funding for lung cancer research. Here's your host, the founder and president of Upstage Lung Cancer, Hilde Grossman.
Hi, I'm Hilde Grossman, and we're so excited to have you with us today backstage at Upstage. And here's my good pal, Jordan Rich.
Hilde, thank you so much. Today, a very important podcast topic for those in the lung cancer community and quite frankly, for any of us. The title of this episode is Listening to the Patient's Voice, because we're all patients sometime. And we have two wonderful guests, Cheryl Davis of Red Thread Solutions and Lauren Coy, who's not only a patient, but a patient advocate. Hilde, we turn it over to you.
Today's topic is something I have thought about for many years. It's the patient's voice in a medical situation. And so I know for a fact all of us will be a patient at one time or another for one reason or another. But today I'd like to start out with one of our guests. It's Cheryl Davis, a wonderful friend of mine that I've known for so many years, and I'm really happy that she's joining us for today. So welcome, Cheryl. It's very interesting. I know you've started your own company after being in pharma for many years, but I wondered how you took this particular direction of being interested in the patient's voice.
Hi, Hilde. First, thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast and to discuss what I think is the most important part of drug development is the patient voice. And the most important part of receiving quality care is hearing the patient voice. I started in research and development and in developing cancer drugs. And then from there, I moved on to drug safety, which is where we collect all of the adverse events and or side effects. And then we analyze that data to understand the risk or benefit for a drug. And when I was in that role, I often, you know, I heard all the adverse events on cancer drugs, and it was early in my career, so they aren't the drugs they are now. They weren't very kind drugs. They were killers. So I heard all those, and I thought to myself, how does someone decide to start this and stay on this? Because I was hearing all the negative parts of it. And at the same time, I had my baby girl, who is now 20. She was diagnosed at 10 years old with an ultra-rare disease. Ultra-rare. And it really took my husband and I really advocating to doctors and switching doctors to have them understand that she wasn't just a collective of symptoms, that there was something big behind it. I really think they would have just like brushed what she had and treated symptoms if we didn't advocate so strongly and share our voice. And so at that point, I decided to work in patient advocacy and make it my mission to share the person who is living with the disease, share their perspective, not just at the time that they're doing treatment planning, but at the time the drug's being developed so that a treatment is actually developed in a way that a person would actually want to take it, and it was valuable. So fast forward 30 years in in the biopharmaceutical industry, and I decided I didn't want to just work with a pharma company anymore. I did want to work with pharma companies to help them bring the voice of the patient in, but I also wanted to work with patient organizations that help educate and put resources and tools in the hands of people living with disease so they can give their voice. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And you do it so well. And you really have put your finger on something that's so very important from the patient's perspective. Having some sense that people will listen to you means everything. It means absolutely everything. I thought I'd tell a personal experience of my own. So when I was diagnosed with lung cancer, some people have heard this story, but it's on our website in exquisite detail. But in any case, it was diagnosed by accident. It was just a series of mishaps that it's the sort of thing you say, well, you couldn't write that sort of thing, but that's what happened. And that's how it was diagnosed. However, once it was diagnosed, it was very early. It was stage 1A. It was kind of a miracle that it was found so early because it was by accident. And so I went to, I only had surgery, and I went to my oncologist for the first visit. And so when I went for the very first visit after surgery, in came the fellow, not the doctor, but the fellow came. And the fellow said, oh, this could metastasize, this could be this, this could be that. You're going to need all this, you know, chemotherapy. And this was already like 15 years ago, so there wasn't nearly the drugs that there are now. Anyway, so he painted a very dire picture. So my daughter and husband were with me at the time. We all looked at each other like, oh no, what's this? So my daughter got very upset and thought, okay, well, you should do all this, she says. Anyway, a few minutes later, in walks the doctor. The doctor's got a big smile, and she said, oh, it's just wonderful. You know, we're all done. You had surgery. It's all taken care of. Well, meantime, you know, we had all had three heart attacks sitting in the office waiting for the doctor to come. And so this is my story of actually having had a voice that was listened to. So after the fellow left, I said to my oncologist, I said, look, you can never do this. You can never have somebody else come up front and talk to your patient, especially when you don't have the same point of view or the same information or the same thoughts about what the course of treatment is going to be. So to her credit, she offered me another time to come in before her usual office hours, and we talked it over. And she said, look, if you want to go somewhere else, I will send you somewhere else. I promised to get you somebody good. But I'm really sorry, and I actually will never do this again, she said. So I said, well, because you took responsibility and you heard what I had to say, I'm staying with you. It's so important to be able to speak for what your needs are, what your experience is, and if you're lucky, you have somebody who will hear you, as my oncologist did. So I thought I'd just share that as a personal experience. I'll just stay with you, Cheryl, for a moment. I know you're doing some research on that. You're collecting various patients' experiences. You can throw mine into the mix now.
I will. Thanks, Sophie. Yeah,
right. And so you've identified three types of patients. Could you say more?
Some of you have heard the word patient journey. And I prefer to call it a patient experience map, because I know some people don't like the word journey because it seems like a trip somewhere fancy, and it's not.
There are all kinds of journeys, right?
Right. I guess there's all kinds of journeys. So what we do is we collect not just the medical journey, but really the emotional journey. Because Hildy, what you just mentioned is you got into a situation where there wasn't a lot of empathy and a lot of education. There was just like something blurted out. And I'm guessing that all of you at that moment felt like shutting down. Am I wrong? Like, you were probably shocked and felt like shutting down. But knowing you, you fought through that, and
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like, just to have a postscript to my story, which I hope inspires every single person listening, they removed the fellow from clinical work, would not allow that person to see patients anymore, and was put into a research position. So I'm again saying, I can't guarantee that every time you advocate for yourself, you get what you need, but don't hold back.
Right. Be like Hildy. Think, what would Hildy do? So there, what we found in all our research is that there are three prominent personas or types of people. There's the first one that's called the listener. And the listener will go in and just do what the doctor said, just listen. They don't necessarily want to hear too much ahead of time what's going on because it scares them, or because they just feel like doctors are the ones that know best. And then the next one is called the active learner. And the active learner really does want to engage with the doctor and have meaningful conversations about their what kind of quality of life they want, what will work with them. But they just don't have the education to understand their options and weigh in, or they just don't know how to ask questions or which questions to ask. And then there's the last one, that's the self-advocate. And this is the person that is probably going to all of the oncologists, where all the oncologists meet and learn about new data themselves. And they're searching on in literature that's been peer-reviewed, which means that it's the highest standard of literature, and they understand the medical terminology. And so they're going into their doctor's office with their own research, incredible research, and driving their plan. So what we've learned is that even though there are these three types, you can work, we can educate and train each of the different types of people to make sure that they are part of what is happening to them. And not only part of what is happening to them, but they are making the choice that they want to treat, they want to go into a treatment plan that really works for them. So that's really what we found. So the listener, what a lot of the education is going into educating their loved ones and making sure their loved ones are there with them, because they might just shut down in front of doctors. I know I do. I sit there and I have 10,000 questions in the background to ask them. And then I sit there and say, yes, ma'am, I'll do it. You know, so it's really, even for me, it is having those, you know, talking with somebody else who pretends to be a doctor to really just train me. And the second one, this active learner, they can really take advantage of what patient organizations have to offer. Hilde partners with several patient organizations, like, for instance, Longevity or GoTo, and they have people who will walk you through exactly how to engage and give you plain language to understand all the different treatment options so that you can engage. And the self-advocate, we want to help those individuals find the scientific articles they want without having to search too far. Does that make sense, Hilde?
It makes total sense. And I really want to discuss these types in more detail, because I think it will help everyone who's listening to this podcast. And I think before going into those three, I would like to introduce our other wonderful guest today, who's also been on a journey. I like the word journey because it feels like a journey in the lung cancer experience, and that is Lauren Poy. Welcome. I'm so glad you're with us today. You've got quite a story also. I think we all have our own stories and our own experiences, but I would love for you to share with our audience what your own experience is.
Thank you, Hilde, for inviting me on today and all the work you do for the lung cancer community. And Cheryl, thank you for being an advocate for us patients who are trying to advocate as well. It's so important. So my story with lung cancer is kind of crazy. When I was about 10 years old, I started growing into asthma when my twin sister and all my friends grew out of their asthma. All of a sudden, I just couldn't breathe. So from the age of like 10 until 20, I kept getting bouts of pneumonia and bronchitis. And the doctors just kept giving me antibiotics and new inhalers and telling me that, you know, I'm good. It's just adult onset asthma. And then when I was about 22, I started spiking these random fevers of about 103 degrees just out of nowhere, and I couldn't breathe. I remember calling my mom at college one day, and I was just laying on the cold dorm room floor because my body temperature was just so high and I couldn't breathe. And then again, I would just keep going to doctors, and they just kept saying, it's a sinus infection, it's an upper respiratory infection. And no inhalers would help, no antibiotics would help. And then it was 2020, and I was convinced I was the first COVID case just because I kept having coughing and phlegm and fevers. And in 2021, I went to go swim in a lake, and I started drowning immediately. I just couldn't breathe. And 2 months later, they had discovered that I had a collapsed lung through a chest x-ray. I kept telling people that I think I have lung cancer. And everybody just kept telling me, you know, you don't live with smokers. We don't have radon, the high level of radon in the house. We don't have family history of it. There's no way you have lung cancer. And I'm like, well, I have 9 out of 10 symptoms. You know, I'm just not coughing up blood, but every other symptom I had. And I finally went in for a chest x-ray because I had a 106-degree fever and I was hallucinating and I'm God. Like, something needs to be done. And when I went to the emergency room, I was there for 11 hours and they went to go send me home with more antibiotics. They just said it was a collapsed lung, probably due to pneumonia, probably due to maybe when you went swimming in the lake, you got some infection or something in your lung that just wasn't treated. And I was in the hospital with my mom and she and I were just looked at the doctor and said, we will take the antibiotics, but we've been on antibiotics for 2 months now. We need a CAT scan on the books. And they kept trying to send us away. And we were like, we are staying in this bed until we get a CAT scan on the books. And so after 11 hours, they finally agreed to give us a CAT scan. And so that was in November and my CAT scan was right before Christmas. And it was a Friday night and they told me that, you know, expect results on Monday. And within 20 minutes, they had called me back and he just said, I know I'm not supposed to call patients after hours, but I needed to let you know before Christmas that you do have a tumor and we're going to set you up with a specialist. The soonest we can get you in is at the end of April, early May. And so I was told I had a tumor in my body and they wanted me to wait 5 to 6 months to figure out what was going on. So the day after Christmas, I called my insurance company and I got a list of every single specialist in the area and I called every single number and finally somebody picked up and told me to come in on New Year's Eve. So I went in and he looked at my CAT scan and before the doctor said anything to me, he just said, did you have anything to eat for breakfast today? And I was like, yeah, I had some coffee and cereal. And he goes, well, if you didn't, we'd be putting you into emergency surgery right now. We need to remove this tumor. So a week later, I went in for my bronchoscopy and they removed most of my tumor. And then on January 10th of 2022, I got an email when I was at work that my tumor had tested positive. So I was diagnosed through an email. And when my oncologist called me about 20 minutes later, I was livid. I was working with kids at the time. So I had a room full of children. And then I got an email thinking it was a statement from my bronchoscopy, but it was telling me that I had cancer. And my oncologist agreed with me that she hates it when they send out the emails and the lab results before the doctor can talk to you. And at that point, they had told me that the next step was to remove 2 inches of my lung for wedge resection around where the tumor was for the bronchoscopy. And then by March, it ended up being the whole lower lobe was going to be removed. And then when I went into surgery on March 15th, they had told me, when I woke up, I had the lower lobe and the middle lobe removed because the tumor was bigger than they had expected. And then they told me that I would never be a runner. I would never hike again. I would even probably struggle to go up a flight of stairs just because of having that much removed. But I was like, I was 24 years old. And I just said, like, I'm not limited. I'm not limiting myself at 24 years old. So I just forced myself to get up and walk and force myself every day to go a little bit farther and try new things. And now I'm running, I'm doing half marathons, I'm hiking, and yeah.
Yay. Well, again, it's the power of the voice. And it's difficult. It's so difficult to face the whole medical establishment who says you're too young. This couldn't be possible in your early 20s. That's silly. No, it's got to be an infection. And all of the information coming back. And, you know, it's like hats off to you. And hopefully this is something to encourage everyone listening to you know, stay with what you believe and keep asking questions and keep getting the best possible care that you can. So that brought me back to something Cheryl said a minute ago. One of her categories was the self-advocate. You and your mother were clearly advocating for yourselves in a way that you weren't getting advocates around you. So I think that's so great. So it made me think, Cheryl, you need a subcategory for the self-advocate. And what I mean by that is me. So I'm the kind of person, and I'm going to guess Lauren must be too. You know, if my fingernails are chipping, I'm going to look up everything on the internet that I can find. Why are my fingernails chipping? You know, do I need different nail polish? Should I stop nail polish? Should I take a vitamin? What's this? What's that? I'll look up everything there is to know about nail chipping. I'm just being silly. Hopefully understand that, listeners. But in any case, it was very interesting for me when I was diagnosed with lung cancer. My husband became that person who was researching everything there was online. And for me, my way of coping with this was to find the absolute top-notch, best surgeon and best oncologist I could find, and then use my own kind of gut as I talked to them about what was going on to see if things made sense or not. So I didn't really go to the internet. I didn't read everything there was. In fact, that felt like it was going to jack up my anxiety. So for me, my choice, as clearly a self-advocate, was to find the best people possible. But that's not always so easy. Lauren, it sounds like that's true for your situation. So what are your thoughts about that, Cheryl? About how do people find the best advocates? I always say I've got the arrogance of living in Boston with, you know, one of the best medical systems in the world, but not everybody lives in, you know, in this kind of environment. People, we've done a podcast on people in rural areas and people who have not been well educated or people whose language is not, you know, their first language is not English, all kinds of people. You know, what's that process of kind of insisting on finding the best person? How does one go about that?
Hilde, you listen to your gut a lot, right?
Yes.
So first and foremost, you do have access to some of the best academic cancer specialty centers in the world, right? You're very lucky. But there are very, very good community cancer centers everywhere, right? It's just hard to know, are you getting the highest quality of care? And I think, again, I'm going to bring this back to patient organizations. So patient organizations, like any of the ones that I mentioned previously, they have the best, highest qualified doctors on their medical boards, right? So if you contact one of the patient organizations, they will have a lot to say and give you a lot of choices. And the whole thing is choices, right? It has to be your choice. You have to drive it. In fact, I think a couple of the organizations actually have an accreditation, okay? So physicians will seek to be accredited by this organization. And the organization only accredits them if they are up to date in the latest treatment options, all the medical clinical stuff. But more importantly, how do they treat patients? How do they listen to patients? And so, you know, you've got organizations out there that have already created lists, and their navigation can even connect you. So what Lauren said is it was going to be April until I saw somebody. No way. No way. And if you don't know where to start, then, and you're not ready to pick up the phone, then I would say call one of these organizations because they will do it for you. So that's my two cents. If you're with somebody, a doctor, and you offer your opinion or you bring in questions and they don't have time for you, or they just don't want to listen to you, they want to do what they want to do, you can leave them. Leave them. If they're not giving you what you want, don't be afraid to go find somebody who is. That's my point.
That's so important, to empower yourself to feel like this doesn't feel like it's good enough. As Lauren was saying, you know, another round of antibiotics after months of antibiotics, just that's not good enough. But I interrupted you. What were you saying?
Where your husband was doing all that searching on the internet, I think it's important to educate yourself. I think doing a Google search cold is dangerous.
Say okay. Why? Say
yeah,
why?
I'm going to tell you why, because a lot of that information that people are sharing isn't true. I've heard of people who decided to take mushrooms instead of receiving their immunotherapy because they read something. I'm not saying not to go out and research, but what I am saying is maybe start with the patient organizations or your hospital's website and look for information that's already been filtered, you know, and that it's good. And even a lot of people, and I understand this, they want to hear from others in their shoes, right? And so there are a lot of online communities that are actually moderated by healthcare professionals. So they're not interrupting any of the conversations that tell you, if you take this drug, this is how I felt, or, you know, they're not interrupting the authentic conversations or filtering them. But what they do in these online communities is if something that wasn't true was said, they will correct it. And so that's another place that you can go and learn from. And because I know a lot of people want to hear exactly like you did this trial or you took this, what was it like? And that's a really good place to start.
I just want to follow up on what you're saying, that upstage lung cancer belongs to a consortium of lung cancer advocate organizations, and it's all over the United States. And the umbrella is in Lung Can. So if you look up Lung Can, you'll see all these various organizations and what they do and what they offer. And I think it's a wonderful resource. Looking this up is free.
It's free.
Yes, free. That's a good point. And Lauren, so to go to your journey, so you've got all this, take another antibiotic. So what did you do to find the best care you could get for yourself?
Again, I just called every specialist my insurance company would accept. And finally, again, I live in the Boston area too, so we have so many amazing doctors and resources here. And luckily, I lucked out with the hospital that called me back, was able to take me in, was efficient, was very helpful. Even all the doctors came and visited me after my surgery. They all came to my hospital room and checked in on me. And I get I have their personal phone numbers and emails too. So if something happens, if I'm just having trouble breathing, immediately they're my lifeline. They're there for me. Again, when I first was diagnosed, I knew nothing about lung cancer. I knew nothing about cancer in general. I was 22 when all my symptoms really started going, and I was 24 when I was diagnosed. And even after my surgery and my diagnosis, I had no resources. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where to meet other people who had lung cancer. And I went online and I just started looking up lung cancer support groups, lung cancer events. And eventually I found, you know, Lung Strong, Longevity, Upstage Lung Cancer, GOT, you know, I found all of these on my own in the White Ribbon Project. And thank God that the lung cancer community is so welcoming and so loving and everything. And I've even had second opinions by my other lung cancer friends. They're like, go see my oncologist, just get a second opinion, make sure they got everything and it was the right choice. And it's honestly, I learned everything that I know about lung cancer now through the people I've met through lung cancer.
I've heard people comment that I was mentioning Lung Can, and I'm not sure how many organizations at this point, 25, 30, don't quote me on that, but something like that across the whole United States. We're completely non-competitive. We're just not. It's a very collaborative group of organizations and people who run these organizations, and we're all in for the same reason, wanting to do the best we can, wanting to get the best research, wanting to be at the forefront, which we are. A lot of the information, especially like on immunotherapy, started with lung cancer patients and now, you know, is in all kinds of areas for other types of cancers. So there's no reason to be halted by anyone in any circumstance that shuts you down at all. So as Cheryl said, if it doesn't work, if you go head on to somebody that's not listening to you, you know, please know that you can look elsewhere one way or another. So I think that's very important. So
I want to tell a story.
Please.
So this is why it's important. Okay, so there was a gentleman that I met with lung cancer. He was an avid golfer. Like, he got his diagnosis, I think, 2 days after he retired. And his whole dream of retirement was to golf every day. And then the medication that his oncologist first offered to him, when he was describing the side effects, he said that it would cause nerve pain in his hands and would likely make it impossible for him to golf. And then he went on to explain why it is he's going to take this treatment option. This gentleman went home and he thought, okay, this is just going to be my life. And then somebody said, no, tell him what you want. Tell him that you are, you know, for you, your joy, your quality of life is about playing golf. And so he did. He called back and he said, look, I'm really nervous about this hand issue. And what I value so much in life is the ability to play golf. And you know what his oncologist said is, thank you for telling me. There is a different option we can go with that has a different way of working, but is a really good option. And it doesn't have that side effect. Why don't we do that?
That's great. And again, the point is, if you have an oncologist who listens and then will offer to adjust their treatment idea because of what you, the patient, have to say, then you've got yourself a great, great doctor. Not all of them will. I also know a gentleman who tried to advocate for himself and who had read everything there was about his own treatment and had some, you know, negative effects, like, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Take what I'm telling you. And then you're now the bad patient. You're not cooperative. Don't allow yourself to stay in that kind of situation if this happens to you. I think, again, as Cheryl pointed out, and I'll repeat, there are options. Even if you live in an area where there are, you know, I always think of something like the Dakotas or some place where I don't see, you know, massive gatherings of health facilities, or you have to travel for long ways or long distances. Check with some of the organizations that Cheryl mentioned or in LungCan and see what kind of opportunities there might be with telehealth and other options. So,
you know, Hildy, a lot of times those organizations have access to patient assistance funds. So if you feel like, oh, well, I can't leave because I can't afford to go somewhere, they'll have transportation and lodging options to help you do that. So it doesn't mean that, let's say you go to a big institution for a second opinion, you could have that institution help with your treatment plan, that and they may coordinate back with your community oncologist, right? So it's not as if every single time you need something, you have to go all the way there. So that's just, I just don't want anyone to think just because I'm in a community that doesn't have this and I'm not in Boston that I can't help myself, because you most certainly can.
Right. In fact, that's exactly what happened with another friend of mine who lived in Maine, not close to any particular meccas of medical care as we think about it, but was able to coordinate his care with Dana-Farber in Boston. And so he got the best of both worlds, living where he did in more rural area, having access to wonderful care. So many wonderful things we've talked about today. I'm always so impressed with the guts and the grit of our guests. I hope that's always an inspiration to everyone who listens. As I said before, everyone will be a patient at some point in their lives. So I hope this particular podcast will help. Thank you so much, Cheryl. And thank you, Lauren, for participating. You've certainly enriched this topic so much. And for all of you who are listening, stay tuned for our next podcast and make sure you're up to date with all the earlier ones. They're all great. I can say that because we've had great guests. Right, Jordan, who has been silent all along?
Absolutely agree with you. And today is no exception. I do keep silent because it's too interesting for me to interrupt. But I will say your point about all of us being patients is true. And we all have to accept that fact and understand we have control, more control than we think. So thanks to our two wonderful guests and to you, Hildy, as always.
Well, thanks to you too, Jordan, as always. And we'll see you all next time.
To find out how you can join Upstage Lung Cancer in raising awareness and funding to beat lung cancer, visit our website, upstagelungcancer.org. We invite you to subscribe and download our podcast, available on all platforms. And we love reviews and ratings. After all, we're showbiz people. There's more entertainment and inspiration to come on the next podcast episode of Backstage at Upstage.